For nearly 30 years, a man by the name of Reuben Mattis had been selling ice cream in New York. It was his family's own recipe, and he made a rather modest living selling it. Then Reuben had an inspiration. He had lived in this country during the boom times of the late 30s and 40s and 50s, and he'd lived long enough to understand that most Americans were convinced that the best foods were exotic foods originating from somewhere else in the world. So in 1959, Mr. Reuben Mattis invented a make-believe exotic name, Häagen-Dazs, for his ice cream. It was the same family recipe with a few new flavors, only this time it was marketed under this exotic, hard-to-pronounce, difficult, made-up name. He'd also had a map of Scandinavia printed on the carton, as if that's where it came from. And with that, sales took off. And the rest is ice cream history. What Reuben Mattis had discovered was not just a better way to sell ice cream. He discovered something about human nature. We are impressed by what's on the carton. We care about image, less about substance. We have been talking about that very thing as we've been discussing religion and the road to hell, and we come to the end of chapter 2 in the book of Romans. In the latter part of chapter 2, you remember Paul has identified the best-looking carton he could find, the most religious person he could locate, and that would be the faithful Jew. And he has delivered the rather startling news to his generation and to ours that it's possible to be religious without being redeemed. And his illustration in verses 17 to the end of this chapter has been the faithful religious Jew. The Jews, it were, had the right name printed on the carton. They had been stamped on each package with the right marking, and they were best sellers. In fact, if you wanted to sell religion, do it through them. But Paul revealed that the faithful Jew had been relying on the wrong things, the external image and the physical markings of the covenant. Much like people today rely on the outward symbol, do they not? I've asked many people, are you sure if you died you're going to heaven? And I'll get answers like, well, of course I'm sure, I've been baptized. Or of course I'm sure I belong to so-and-so church. Or I was born into a Christian home. Or I've done a lot of pretty good things in my life. Hidden in their answers is the deception of religion. Religion has to do with the name, the outside of that ice cream carton, whether or not it will sell, regardless of what's on the inside. Religion will always focus on what we do and create with our hands. True Christianity focuses on the heart. In the last verse or two of Romans chapter 2, Paul uses contrasting vocabulary subtly yet forcefully as he reveals the difference between a religious image and a relationship with God. If you have your Bibles and you have opened them already to chapter 2, notice verse 28. Paul writes, "For he is not a Jew who was one outwardly, neither is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh." Verse 29, "But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that which is of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the letter. And his praise is not from men, but from God." So you have the outwardly here contrasted with the inwardly, the flesh contrasted with the heart, the letter of law contrasted with the Spirit, and man's praise contrasted with God's praise. Such is the contrast between religion and a relationship. A religion that talks about God, but a relationship that knows God. And it's hard for us to perhaps identify with the Jews. Most of us perhaps are Gentiles. And it certainly would have been hard to identify with the fact they would have been so stunned by this paragraph. It was shocking for them to hear that even though they had descended from Abraham, they had the markings of the covenant on their bodies. They had been given the guardianship of the Torah or the law. They had a past history with God's unmistakable blessing. That did not automatically make them right with God. Circumcision of the flesh, Paul has said, is not as important as having a circumcised heart. In fact, Paul's point is really this. Not having a circumcised heart makes null and void circumcised flesh. Now, this wasn't new, by the way, to Paul. You go all the way back in the Old Testament, and I've read a number of passages where the prophets talk about the issue of being circumcised in the heart. Jeremiah spoke for God and said, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, that I will punish all who are circumcised and yet uncircumcised. For all the nations are uncircumcised, and all the house of Israel are uncircumcised of heart." Chapter 9, verses 25 and 26. In Leviticus 26, verse 38, and in the Torah it says, "But you will perish among the nations, and your enemies' land will consume you. So those of you who may be left will rot away because of their iniquity in the lands of your enemies, and also because of the iniquities of their forefathers, they will rot away with them. If, however, they confess their iniquity, or if their uncircumcised hearts become humbled so that they then make amends for their iniquity, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob, Isaac, and Abraham, and I will remember the land." You remember what the Lord said to Samuel many, many years ago when he said, God sees differently than man sees. Man looks on the carton, right? Man looks on the outward appearance. But God looks at the what? The heart. In other words, being right with God is a matter of the heart. By the way, what does the heart refer to? Is the Bible talking about that muscle in your chest that beats 70, 75 or so times a minute? Well, in the Hebrew Bible, the word most often translated heart is the word lev. And it refers to the motives, the feelings, the affections, the desires of a person. But the word lev also refers to a person's will, their goals, their thoughts, and their intellect. And in the New Testament, the word most often translated heart is the word cardia, which basically means the same thing. It's that Greek word that gives us the formation of our words, cardiology and cardiologist. Gerhard Kittel, in his massive 9-volume work on the Greek New Testament, which anchors at nearly one shelf in my library, described the cardia, or the heart, in the New Testament as the center of the inner life of man and the source of all the forces and functions of soul and spirit. The heart stands for the whole of the inner being of man. Basically, the word heart refers to the true person. Regardless of a person's name on the carton, regardless of the map, regardless of the marketing strategy printed on the package, the heart refers to that which is truly on the inside. And the faithful Jew in Paul's day thought God's work was all done on the outside. The man had been born a Jew, the woman who'd conceived by a circumcised Jew, they were externally adhering to God, they were safely within the covenant of Abraham. In fact, they were direct descendants of Abraham. What more could be needed to be accepted by God? The Jew believed, as I've mentioned, that Abraham sat by the gate of hell and would never allow a circumcised Jew to enter. They thought they were safe, but they weren't. It struck me as I was studying this passage in Romans chapter 2 that Paul uses the same exact vocabulary as Jesus Christ did 30 or 40 years earlier in a conversation with a faithful Jew. In fact, Paul explains what has already been illustrated in John chapter 3. So would you turn there where Jesus has a private conversation with a faithful Jew? It's a conversation that will eventually revolutionize this man's life. He'll appear later in the Gospels as the man who loans his tomb to the Messiah. And it's not a loss. Jesus will only need it for a few days. But this is where he meets with the Lord. While you're turning, perhaps you're aware that the most famous of verses is found also in the same chapter, John chapter 3, verse 16. Say it with me. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. That's right. Many of us know that verse. Not many perhaps know to whom Jesus said those words. Well, we're told in John chapter 3, verse 1. Now, there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. Now, we ought to stop here long enough to know what this man was and who we're introduced to. If the faithful Jew that Paul referred to in Romans chapter 2 was not good enough to get into heaven, well, this man here represented among the Jews the most likely of candidates to enter heaven because of what we're told. We're told that he was a Pharisee. Now, the truth is, when you and I think of a Pharisee, we think of a hypocrite, don't we? Because we think of all the times the Lord called them hypocrites. And he dealt with the religious leaders with harshest of terms. We think of them as proud, legalistic people who played a religious game but lived another life. And that would be a correct perception of some, if not many of them. But there were, however, others who were deeply devoted to the law. They had dedicated their lives to the keeping of the law. In fact, the Apostle Paul was once a Pharisee. These were the Jewish men who, because of their passion for the God of Abraham, joined the Kabbura. This was the brotherhood known as the Pharisee. They entered into this brotherhood by taking a pledge in the presence of three witnesses that they would dedicate their lives to obeying every statement of the law, both Mosaic law and scribal law. And that's where it really got interesting. Because the scribes had spent generations developing what they called the scribal law codified in the Mishnah. There was also the Talmud, which was a commentary on the Mishnah that explained and developed and tried to answer all of the questions that would emanate from simple commands of God through Moses. A good illustration would be the command of God through Moses to keep the Sabbath day holy. They weren't to work. Well, the question would be, how do you define work? What does work mean? It would be the scribes who would codify with thousands of regulations what work truly meant. And the Pharisee then would keep it. Here's some of what they came up with. On the Sabbath day, they could only drink enough milk for one swallow at a time. More than one swallow at a time would be work for their mouths. They could not lift a spoon to their lips weighing more than one fig. More than that would be lifting a burden. The Pharisees and scribes were embroiled over the debate as to whether a woman on the Sabbath could pick up her baby, or if he could move a chair from one room to the other, or even if a man could wear his wooden dentures on the Sabbath. Now, it was considered in the Mishnah to be work to tie a knot and to untie a knot. However, they went on to say, it was permissible for a woman who was getting dressed on the Sabbath, it was permissible to tie a knot in her girdle. And thank heaven for that. It was permissible to draw water from the well on the Sabbath, but if the rope broke, you were in trouble because you couldn't tie a knot with a new rope and an old rope. That would be work. However, you could take your wife's girdle, tie one side to the rope, tie the other side to the bucket, and draw water from the well. I'm not kidding. This is codified law here. Just in case the rope breaks, you know what to do. You think, well, that's a little ridiculous. Yet on the other hand, what strikes me is here is a people so committed to the incredible inconvenience of keeping thousands of regulations that they did so in order to please God. And I wonder how many inconveniences would we be willing to go through in our walk with Christ. It's my observation that most of us allow only one or two inconveniences before we begin to grumble that God isn't all that we had bargained for. Our text says that Nicodemus was one of the Kabbura. He was one of the dedicated men to the Mishnah, to scribal law. The latter part of verse 1 also tells us something. It tells us that Nicodemus was a ruler of the Jews. The word archon indicates that he was then a member of the Sanhedrin, one of the select 71 men in Israel. In fact, later on in the text, Jesus refers to him as the teacher with a definite article, the. This man was probably the most popular teacher of scribal law in the days of Christ. He was a member of the Sanhedrin, the teacher that was respected and well known. So here is this man. By the way, one of the roles of the Sanhedrinist was to examine a man who claimed to be a prophet to see if he indeed was a true prophet of God. So what you have here is Nicodemus coming to Jesus at night to examine him to see if he's truly a prophet of God. A man well respected, well known, so well known that he comes under cover of night. He didn't want to start tongues wagging with his coming. He came to him by night, verse 2 says, and he said to him, "Rabbi, we know that you have come from God as a teacher, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him." That was a wonderful introduction in this conversation, because you understand here the debate has already been raging as to the source of Jesus' power. By now, there is an entire sect of these religious leaders that believe that Jesus was empowered by Beelzebul. They believe that he had satanic power to do the signs or miraculous things that he had done. What Nicodemus is telling him here is he's just letting him know that he's not one of those men. He says, "I know that you're empowered by God. I know that you've come from God." But this was also a polite way of basically asking Jesus, "What is the heart of your message?" He must have seen earlier in the day Jesus cleansing the temple and claiming it to be his Father's house. That really, I'm sure, piqued his interest. He's asking him, "What is your message as a prophet from God?" And Jesus responds by giving him his primary message in verse 3. "Truly, truly, I say to you," he said, "unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God." This is a shocking statement. Why? Because Jesus said, in effect, "Truly I say to you, Nicodemus, unless you're born again, you can't go to heaven." So what Jesus, in effect, just told one of the leading Jewish candidates for heaven was he wasn't going. Nicodemus, the Lord, in effect, is saying, has done a lot of right things, but he hasn't done the right thing in order to get into heaven. Nicodemus, being a faithful Jew, had merely assumed that he was already part of the kingdom. He's a son of Abraham. He has a right to heaven. Well, just as the news of from Paul to his audience in Romans 2 was shocking to them, here's the illustration of when it first came out to a religious, faithful Jew, "You're not going to heaven." It was a shocking statement, but it was also a difficult statement. Verse 4, Nicodemus said to him, "How can a man be born when he's old?" In other words, you're telling me I got to be born again? Well, how do I get back into my mother's womb and be born? Verse 4. In other words, what do you mean I have to be born again? He was confused. And so would we be if we didn't have passages like John chapter 3. Well, Jesus will explain himself to Nicodemus with two propositions. These two truths will change his thinking forever, and it will stand on its ear, typical Judaism of that day. It will reveal the first inklings of this dramatic change that is about to happen. The first proposition is this: the physical birth into Abraham's family isn't sufficient for redemption. Now, you know, if you've been studying with me, that Paul has been saying basically the same thing in Romans chapter 2. Jesus goes on here in verse 5 to say, "Truly I say to you, unless one is born of water and the Spirit," he's not going to explain this birth, "he cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. Unless one is born of water and the Spirit." Now, just what does water refer to? You pull books off the shelf, you go to different churches, you'll hear a number of different views. Some would say it's a reference to the cleansing aspect of the new covenant. Others would say, well, this is a reference to John the Baptizer and his baptism by water of repentance. Another would say, well, this is just a reference to the Holy Spirit. Or some would say this is a reference to the cleansing of the Word, which is often in the New Testament referred to as water. Others would say this is a reference to the necessity of water baptism. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Jesus is not teaching here that the new birth comes through water baptism. In fact, throughout the New Testament, consistently, baptism is connected with death, not birth. While water baptism is necessary for spiritual obedience, it is not necessary for spiritual birth. I was baptized personally years ago as an older teen, and I was baptized not so that I could go to be with the Lord, but as a way to show that I was going to be with the Lord. Not so I could be accepted by Christ, but to reveal that I was identified with Christ who had already accepted me. If you want to know what verse 5 means, go to verse 6. It explains it. That which is born of the flesh is flesh. That is, this is the natural first birth. And that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. This is the second birth, and this one is supernatural. So he explains it here. In his analogy, being born of water is a reference to physical, natural birth. It's interesting to know that the Greek words here are exudatos and can be literally translated born out of water. It's also insightful that in the Hebrew Bible or language, the word, the verb to give birth is a verb that literally translated says the rupturing of membrane. I have literally seen the results of that very thing. I won't gore you with all the details, but I can remember being in the delivery room for the last time, having our last child. And we were about to have our fourth child. I say we rather generously. We were in the labor and delivery room, and some medical personnel came in and broke Marcia's what? Water. Up until then, our baby had been floating in a sack filled with amniotic fluid. We refer to that as water. The doctor, by breaking that sack, basically let the water out of the swimming pool. And just like you would be, nobody wants to swim in a pool without any water. This is the incentive to get the baby out of the pool. I know I'm using layman's terms, but I know you're going to get it here. Our children, your children, we all in this auditorium were born exudata. We were all born out of water. That's what verse 5 is referring to, exudatas, the physical birth. Jesus goes on to say there has to be a second birth. Why then make the mention of the first birth to Nicodemus? I mean, isn't that a moot point? Well, yes, if you're a good Jew, that's the way you're thinking. The first birth does it. You're born related to Abraham. All you have to do is be born and that's it. You're in. Jesus says, well, you have that one, but you need another one. You have to be born again. The physical birth is not enough for redemption. He goes on in verse 7 to say, don't be amazed that I said to you, you must be born again. The wind blows where it wishes, and you hear the sound of it, but do not know where it comes from and where it is going. So is everyone who is born of the Spirit. In other words, you don't see this birth. There's no labor and delivery room. This is an invisible transaction. This is an invisible birth. You don't see it, but you see the results of it. Like the wind that blows through a tree, you don't see the wind, but you see the effect of the wind on the limbs of the tree. Nicodemus said to him in verse 9, how can these things be? Jesus answered and said to him, are you the teacher of Israel and do not understand these things? Truly, I say to you, we speak of what we know and testify of what we have seen, and you do not accept our testimony. If I told you earthly things and you do not believe, how will you believe if I tell you heavenly things? No one has ascended into heaven but he who descended from heaven, the Son of Man. Now he's about to give him the second rather startling proposition. The first one was that his physical birth was not sufficient for redemption. The second truth is this, that the second birth cannot occur until the Messiah experiences death. And that would be totally foreign to the Jewish mind. That the Messiah, the true Redeemer, would come and not institute a kingdom but die? That would be shocking to them. But he will say, unless the Messiah dies, you can't be born again. Look at verse 14. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. The verse refers here back to one of the most unique stories in the Old Testament. The book of Numbers, you may remember if you've read it, chapter 21, where Israel is rebelling against God. And in judging Israel, God sent poisonous snakes into their camp. The Bible called them fiery serpents, perhaps because of the hot fever that ultimately overtook them and led to their death, a predominant result of the serpent's venom. Well, the people, if you've read the story, you remember, cried out for mercy. And God instructed Moses to do something very unusual. Instead of administering some sort of antidote, instead of creating some sort of cure, he said simply, make a brass serpent like the ones you see on the ground and attach it to a long wooden pole and lift it up. And if anybody looks at that serpent, they'll be healed and saved from death. Why not develop medicine? Why not require their hands to work for a cure. It would have given them all something to do. It would have satisfied every natural instinct on behalf of man to work for his cure. The fact that we're not told to make a human remedy is indicative of the greater fact that there is no human remedy for sin. Nothing but death awaits us, and it is the proving fact that we have been bitten by sin in that we will all die. We are all mortally wounded. We just don't know when we'll die. But we all will. And there's nothing we can do in creating a cure. What does religion do? Donald Gray Barnhouse, in his wonderful commentary, wrote this: in the religious fashion of our day, in the religious fashion of mankind, there would have been an immediate rush to incorporate or form the Society for the Extermination of the Fiery Serpents. There would have been badges for the coat lapel, cards for district workers, secretaries for organizational branches, pledge cards, and mass rallies. There would have been a publication office formed and a weekly journal printed to tell of the progress of the work. There would have been photographs of heaps of serpents that had been killed by the faithful workers, all of them feverishly trying by human effort to overcome the serpent's bite of sin. Let us accompany one of the zealous workers as he might take a pledge card into the tent of a stricken victim. The man has been bitten and the poison has already affected his limbs. He lies in feverish agony, the glaze of death already coming to his eyes. The zealous member of the Society for the Extermination of Fiery Serpents tells him all has been done to combat the serpents and urges the man to pay and join. The dying victim fumbles in his pocketbook for money and then takes a pen in his hand. His fingers are held by the worker who helps him form his signature on the pledge and membership card, and the man signs in full and then dies. The incident in Numbers 21 is a prefiguring of Jesus Christ, who became sin for us. The one who was lifted up, the one who literally became wicked evil on our behalf. Salvation, spiritual healing, rebirth, all of those synonymous, comes from simply going, looking to Him. Not at our hands. Not in some religious effort to make things better. Not to find a cure. Not to somehow solve the problem. But look to Him. Believing in Him alone provides the remedy. My friend, you can join a society called a church. You can sign a pledge card. You can give your money away. You can go to Bible lessons and catechisms. And you can get baptized. And you can die without God after having done all of that. We have all been bitten. And our only hope is to look to the cross. He goes on to say in verse 15, that whoever believes may in Him have eternal life. What does it mean to believe? It's a good question. What did Philip mean when he asked the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8, verse 37, do you believe with all your heart? What do we mean when we say you ask Jesus to come into your heart? What did Paul mean in Romans 10, verse 9, when he said you're to believe in your heart that God raised Him from the dead? What's the connection between believing and the heart? Well, remember, the heart is more than a pump inside your chest that beats 70, 75, 80 times a minute, right? In biblical terms, the heart refers to the inner person, the inner function and forces of soul and spirit, mind and intellect. In other words, the heart refers to who you really are. So when Paul said to believe in your heart that God raised Him from the dead and you shall be saved, somebody can say, okay, yeah, I believe all that stuff. I never denied that. I was raised in a home that believed it, and from the time I was knee-high, I believed that. He isn't saying that. He's saying that all the forces and functions of soul and spirit, will and intellect are driven by the truth of Christ being alive. Paul, in effect, says, if you are so gripped by the truth that Christ is the living, resurrected Lord, so much so that He controls and dominates your inner being, you shall be saved. When you ask Jesus Christ to come into your heart, if you're using the word heart biblically, then you're asking Jesus then to take up residency inside the real you, to control the real you, all the forces and function, the will, the mind, the intellect. When you ask Jesus to come into your heart, you're literally asking him not to inhabit the little muscle that beats. You're asking him to inhabit your life. That's why there are those who are deceived by saying, oh yeah, I asked Jesus to come into my heart, and they live like the devil. They're deceived. To ask him in means he dominates, he inhabits, he resides within you. You say, well, I know people that don't believe, and they live good lives. They're ethical. They sound good. They're committed to their family. They're good in business. They have upstanding reputations. How do you know they don't have the truth? But remember, ladies and gentlemen, religion is passionate about the carton. That's all it can do is polish the outside so that it looks good and it sounds good, so that it is ethical. And those things are all good and moral and upstanding. Those are all wonderful. But it focuses on the work of the hands and what we do to remedy that mortal wound, what we do to somehow cure the fact that we will die, all the while ignoring the sin inside the heart, the sinful who we are. What has religion done? Well, Paul in Romans 2 has said it's insufficient. It isn't enough. And Jesus Christ told Nicodemus it wasn't enough. Let me illustrate it this way. Imagine that you've come to an old farmhouse. There's nobody there, just you, and you're thirsty. You're looking for water. And out behind that crumbling old farmhouse is that farmyard, and it's windswept, and the dirt is hard-baked. And you spot over the way that wooden platform, and attached to that on top, coming up through there, is the well pump with the handle. It's all rusty. You can tell it hadn't been used for a long time, but you think there it is. And you go over and you step up onto that wooden platform and you begin to pump that handle and you pump. 5 minutes later, there's nothing but air. 15 minutes later, you're exhausted now and thirstier than ever, and not one drop has come out of that pump. Why? Because the well is dry. You know what religion would do? Religion will scrape away the rust and paint that handle and make it look good and invite people who are thirsty to come and pump. And people will. No, it'll do more than that. It'll get rid of that old pump and it'll put in a new one made of brass. And others will come and think that's a good idea. And all around that farmyard, they will dig their shallow holes and they will place over those holes platforms not connected to water. Remember, religion isn't into water, it's into pumps. And a painter will come and paint a portrait of that landscape that is now littered with pumps that do not produce one drop of water for the thirsty lips of humanity. Jesus Christ basically said, you've got a great looking handle and you look religious and everything looks fine, but my friend, you're not connected to the living water. The well's dry where you're drinking from or trying to. You need to look to me. And that's how you come. Looking to the Son of Man who came to earth to die for sinners, those who will admit they're hopelessly bitten, who believe in their inner being that Jesus Christ is truly alive. And that belief leads to the domination of that living Lord in and through them. The Apostle Paul basically delivered the same verdict to the impressive-looking Jew of his day. He found the best exhibit he could for a religious man. He's talked about the immoral man in chapter 1 and how they're guilty before God. And he's talked about the moral man and how he is upstanding but also guilty before God. And then he ends with this religious man. And he shows how religion is simply another way to hell. He has said three things, basically. The faithful Jew will not be saved by his law. Secondly, the faithful Jew will not be saved by his liturgy. And finally, the faithful Jew will not be saved by his lineage. In other words, what he's saying is don't put all the stock on the name that's on the outside of the carton. Don't depend on the markings. Don't depend on the map that someone has attached that says, here's the way to go. Religion is the road to hell simply because it cares only about the outside of the package and it looks good. It sounds exotic and it sells. Christianity is the road to heaven. It focuses on the condition of the heart. True Christianity is not into appearances and it doesn't sell anything, but it transforms everything, beginning with the heart. Because the core of Christianity, ladies and gentlemen, is a matter of the heart.